You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of July 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
We are currently taking the necessary precautions to both be prepared for an escalation. We have forces on the ground. We've utilised all of our defensive mechanisms, Iron Dome and our Air Force in order to protect and safeguard the civilians of the State of Israel.
As Israel starts a new offensive in Gaza and a US diplomat is expelled from Bahrain, we'll be joined by Xenia Dormandy, US Project Director at Chatham House, and Kathleen Burke, a Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at UCL, to discuss that and the day's other big stories in the Middle East, Europe and the USA.
A poll came out recently, and while it confirmed that Tony Abbott is still a deeply unpopular Prime Minister, it indicated that the average Australian is still behind him, which is fairly curious.
That's our correspondent Adrian Craddock in Melbourne. We'll be checking in with him later, and we'll delve into the exquisite world of rowing outfits. It's all about the Blazers, don't you know? Also ahead, our weekly music review today with Nick Luscombe. But I'll take care of your mind. I lost you, I miss you, I wanna hold you. So great music and plenty more besides coming up right here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Lots to enjoy then in today's programme. Before we begin, let's get the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News with James Luckhurst. Israeli forces have been bombing the Gaza Strip in strikes that Palestinian officials say have killed at least 11 people. The action steps up what threatens to become a long-term offensive against the Islamist group Hamas after scores of rockets hit Israeli towns. After the worst outbreak of violence along the Gaza frontier since an eight-day war in 2012, the Israeli military said a ground invasion of the enclave was possible, though not imminent, and urged citizens within a range of 40 kilometres of the coastal territory to stay close to bomb shelters. The Afghan presidential contender Abdullah Abdullah has claimed victory in last month's poll, despite results giving a lead to his rival Ashraf Ghani. Addressing supporters in the capital, Kabul, Mr. Abdullah repeated claims that the election was marred by fraud. The United States is calling for what it calls a full and thorough review of alleged irregularities. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder has urged countries in Europe and elsewhere to do more to keep their own citizens from travelling to Syria to fight. He warned that the world cannot allow Syria to become a training ground for violent extremists. Speaking in Norway, Mr. Holder said other countries could learn from US efforts to conduct undercover sting operations and use laws against preparing to commit attacks. Tactics, he said, had helped confront the threat in the United States.
We have a mutual and we have a compelling interest in developing shared strategies for confronting the influx of United States and European-born violent extremists into Syria. And because our citizens can travel freely, visa-free, from the United States to Norway and other European states and vice versa, the problem of fighters in Syria returning to any of our countries is a problem for all of our countries.
The Islamist militant group Boko Haram has been blamed for at least 18 attacks on civilians in northern Nigeria in the past 2 weeks. A senior UN official has warned that the escalating violence of the insurgency threatens the security of West Africa. Said Jinit told the UN Security Council that insecurity in northeastern Nigeria, coupled with growing political tensions ahead of planned general elections in 2015, had left the country at a crossroads. The United Nations Human Rights Office has expressed serious concerns over the transfer of 41 Sri Lankan asylum seekers by Australia back to their country. The Australian government returned them after intercepting them in a boat suspected of illegally entering Australia waters. Spokesperson for the Office of the High Commission for Human Rights, Ravina Shamdasani, questioned Australia's brief assessment of the asylum seekers' claims, saying such transfers should not be made in haste.
We are deeply disturbed that Australian authorities on Sunday returned to Sri Lanka 41 people seeking asylum, apparently without adequate screening of their protection claims and needs. International law requires that each and every case be properly and individually examined on its own merits. This is not something that can or should be done hurriedly, remotely, and on the high seas without procedural safeguards and due process guarantees for those involved.
A UN tribunal has awarded Bangladesh nearly four-fifths of an area sprawling nearly 10,000 square miles in the Bay of Bengal, ending a dispute over a sea border with India. The verdict, which was binding on both countries, opens the way for Bangladesh to explore for oil and gas in the Bay of Bengal, the site of important energy reserves. Two senior British government ministers are in India for a second day of talks with the country's new Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. The UK wants to invest in Indian infrastructure and help to develop new cities along a 600-mile stretch between Mumbai and Bangalore. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, James. More from James Luckhurst a little later. I'll be back about the bottom of the hour with the headlines. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we're back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06. It's 1.06 in Shanghai. Well, joining me now with their take on the news here in Studio One are Xenia Dormandy, US Project Director at Chatham House, and Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at UCL. Welcome both to the programme. We'll start today looking at Israel has announced a lengthy offensive against Hamas, or as Israel's defence minister puts it, preparing a campaign against Hamas that will not be completed within a few days. The peace process, if there was one at all in recent months, is clearly pretty far down the road of falling apart. We'll perhaps talk a little bit more about the specifics of what's happening on the ground in a moment. But I just wondered from a sort of US perspective, first of all, and Xenia, if I can start with you, is the US, it's hard to say this, but is it culpable in some way for allowing us to get to this point? I mean, is there any point in looking to the Capitol Hill for blame here, or is this a local issue that's descended into this sort of tit for tat?
I really think, I mean, it's the simple answer is no, America isn't culpable. I mean, there's this, as a former American diplomat, I would say there's an enormous frustration of, on the one hand, people saying, why isn't America more involved? Why isn't America doing more? And on the other hand, saying, why isn't America butting out of our issues? We don't need America. You're just causing trouble. And America can't win. And if you look at some of the changes that President Obama has tried to institute over the last few years, and you look at his recent West Point speech, you essentially see a president who's saying, you know what, and he's not saying this explicitly, but this is the underlying message, we can't win. We can't be held responsible. We can't do things unless people on the ground actually want them to get done. We can't affect change in other countries. You blame us for trying, you blame us for not trying. So actually, why don't we do, and again, this is something that's been very much a tenet of the Obama administration, we will support people who want to take action, but we will not promote democracy, et cetera, which was very much the Bush perspective. And so what you're seeing is a president and a country that is actually trying to make a move to being more supportive of what people want to do on the ground, but accepting the fact that it cannot actually make things happen unless people on the ground want to take action. And I think the what's going on in the Middle East, specifically in Israel and the West Bank and in Palestine, is a great case of the, in point. America's actually put a vast amount, Kerry has put a vast amount of energy in trying to actually get the two sides to come together. What is absolutely abundantly clear is they do not want to come together. They aren't interested in that. And there's nothing the US can do. So, no, is it culpable? Absolutely not.
And would you go along with that, Kathleen? Is it a sort of interesting line between being pragmatic and realistic, I guess, and being sort of defeatist, I guess some might say? Is that unfair? Would you go along with what Xenia says there?
Well, I'd only slightly, I mean, on the whole, I agree with almost everything she said. The only culpable part is the Palestinian not unlikely conviction that they will not be treated equally. Mm-hmm. And therefore, why put it in America's hands? Because they will always lose. So if we want culpability, I think we could put it right there, in fact. And then we go back to politics, and we go back to an inability of either the president or Congress to move out of a place that have been in concrete for the past 50 years.
So if we then look to events on the ground and this rapid deterioration we've seen in recent days, is it unhelpful to look at, you know, who's doing what? Or is it fairly easy to read? You alluded to it already. There's only two sides who aren't interested in any sort of formal process. Is it then interesting to look at maybe what's happening in terms of, you know, the Israeli administration looking at how coherent Palestinian politics are and trying to maybe destabilize that? We see these loose unions because Hamas is under pressure. Is there a vested interest from Israel to not see Hamas back into the fold?
Very clearly. I mean, one of the problems that we find on this situation, but many others as well, is we tend to devolve things down to the most simplistic. You know, the Israelis have one opinion and the Palestinians have another opinion. And what is abundantly clear in this situation, as in many others, is that there are multiple different factions within Israel and there are multiple different factions within Palestine, as there are multiple different factions within Europe, within the United States. And so we can't devolve it down to these kind of simplistic, is it in the Israelis' best interests to make sure that Hamas and Fatah don't get on with one another. It's clearly in the views of Netanyahu, that's what he feels is within his interest, but not necessarily within Israelis writ large. And what is happening there, as it's happening in many other areas, is politics is forcing people down towards the extremes rather than into the center. And somehow one either needs to change the set of incentives, so you strengthen the center, you strengthen the groups that actually want to work together, and you weaken the groups at the extremes, or you have to help the moderates, the those in the center, to actually make their voices heard. And you know, there are certainly things that Europeans, that Americans can do those things to support those within the countries, within the region that hold those views. But it is something that those within those two countries, quite arguably within Jordan, within Egypt, within some of the neighboring countries as well, actually have to come together and put some effort behind.
Of course, the problem is, as long as America or European countries are supporting a person, a faction, they then become known as poodles. Yes. You know, that so they lose, they can lose credibility with their own followers. I mean, could I ask a question myself, in fact, sitting here thinking about it, is that if we don't just focus on Israel, West Bank, Palestine, Gaza, and we put it within the wider context of the Middle East and what's happening now, do you think this will either, they'll be ignored, relatively speaking, because there's bigger fish to fry outside. Do you think that will actually help the situation if no one pays much attention to what's going on there because they're worried about what's happening in Baghdad? Or do you think it will encourage the more extremists on both sides to do what they want now while no one's watching?
I truly don't know the answer to that question. I know that if you look across Europe today, if you look at some of the polls, so take a step away from the Middle East at the moment, but if you look across Europe, you arguably look across the United States, people are becoming more extreme. Republicans and Democrats no longer overlap at all in Congress. The most conservative Democrat and the most liberal Republican do not overlap. You look across Europe, populism is on the rise. You need to look at some of the kind of nationalist parties, and it's very, very clear. And yet we tend to kind of ignore that when we look at the Middle East. And yet many of the same trends are taking place in the Middle East, or at least to the outside eye, they're taking place. You know, can we make an evaluation over whether Israel and Palestine is more serious than what's going on in Syria and Iraq? I don't know. We don't know how these things are going to overlap. The one thing we do know is that unless people on the ground want to come to some kind of coherent compromise together, and this is true whether you're talking about Egypt, you're talking about Bahrain, you're talking about Jordan, Morocco, Tunisia, unless people actually want to come to some kind of compromise, we're not going to get peace, we're not going to get stability. That is the only answer. Which conflict is more serious than the other? I don't know that I can evaluate that.
At least Israel at least has the advantage now of being again in a strong alliance with Egypt. So Gaza is hemmed in, and the tunnels are closed, and rearmament isn't taking place. So in that sense, there might the squeeze might actually do something to lower the temperature.
On the other hand, of course, we have to remember that whereas historically Israel was kind of an status quo power, that's no longer the case, because actually population demographics are making that a very, very problematic dangerous situation for the Israelis. So who knows?
Who knows? You mentioned Bahrain there in your sort of précis of the region. Let's talk about Bahrain briefly, because the nascent Arab Spring was suppressed very immediately back in 2011. And we've also been talking about the difficulties of trying to draw in the various different factions into discussions, and the jeopardy that can bring to diplomats who try and speak to people who perhaps they shouldn't. Tensions on the rise there now, and we've seen Tom Malinowski, the US diplomat, being invited to leave the country this week after meeting with one of the main Shia opposition groups there. It's interesting, isn't it, Kathleen? I mean, we're talking about how to try and go about bringing settlements, bringing some kind of progress in these countries. One way to do that is to try and talk to people who perhaps are on the, if not the extremes, are on the periphery. And yet it's obviously very difficult for diplomats to do that without upsetting some people. How would you assess Tom Malinowski's attempts? He's trying to speak to a leading opposition group. That's a good thing, isn't it?
Well, one would have thought so. I mean, certainly I remember. I know about back in 1974 with the Portuguese Revolution. It came as a blinding surprise to the British because their ambassador and the embassy was not talking to anyone in the opposition, only to the government. And they were caught, shall we say, wrong-footed, to say the least. I mean, diplomats are supposed to keep in touch with all sources of information and being able to touch what's going on in the country. He was doing just what a good diplomat does. It is a problem when, of course, the government doesn't like you doing that. But there must have been, I mean, he made too many arrangements with too many people and too many groups, it seems, for him not to have had some sort of nod and wink that this would be, as long as he didn't make any trouble.
As did, you know, many other diplomats, American diplomats, have met with the opposition. So, I mean, to me, there's something in these stories about Malinowski being effectively, politely asked to leave that we're missing.
Absolutely.
But, you know, as you say, this was planned. This is not news. This has happened all the time, regularly. This is a standard part of American diplomacy, as it is for many other countries. To be expelled from Bahrain, that there's something else. And I wonder, you know, I don't know what it is, but I wonder whether, you know, you have to remember that Tom Malinowski was also a fairly senior in Human Rights Watch. You know,
well, I was going to ask you about this, because obviously he's the US Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights and Labour. We know pretty well about some of the problems involving human rights issues and democratic freedom, or the lack of it, of course, in Bahrain. I mean, surely just on a pragmatic level, he's only dealing with issues that he must be confronting every day. Before we even talk about the political ramifications, he has to deal with these kind of issues. We're in a difficult situation if a diplomat is prevented from dealing with his brief, basically, just because it upsets somebody locally.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, it's as I say, I mean, there has to be, you know, the Bahrainis are clearly sending a message at this time, on this occasion. You know, the US government has regularly criticized the Bahrainis for their human rights actions. You know, Tom Malinowski, as I say, was a senior in Human Rights Watch before going into the government. Human Rights Watch is it is no news to the Bahrainis what Tom Malinowski was going to be doing and was going to be saying. So there's clearly part of the story that we're missing.
We'll have to keep a weather eye on this one, I think. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Tom Edwards. My guests are Zania Dormandy and Kathleen Burke. When we return, we'll be talking about, guns, chemical weapons, and we'll also make a bit of a trip across to look at some US-German relations as well after this.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London, W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Win Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, 20 minutes past the hour. I'm with Kathleen Burke and with Xenia Dormandy. We'll talk a little bit about US-German relations now. Another test, a German intelligence employee reportedly spying for the US. The CIA remains silent. The allegations have caused an understandable uproar amongst German politicians. The harshest reaction has come from the president, Joachim Gauck, who said, one really has to say, enough is enough. Is enough enough, Kathleen, or is this just something we need to get used to and, more to the point, politicians should as well?
I can imagine the CIA chap sitting in the American embassy and this 31-year-old technical whatever comes in and says, look, I've got this material for you. I mean, is the American going to say, get thee behind me, Satan? On the whole, it had been unusual, I think, to turn it down. The Germans are calling it recruiting. It sounds almost as though he was recruiting the Americans, actually, for a nice set of stream of funds that he didn't have before. It's very unfortunate. It's very unfortunate. I mean, the French take these things in their stride. They talk a lot, but they take these things in their stride. The Germans, as we all know, have the background of the Stasi and the Gestapo, and it is becoming alarming. The number of, shall we say, contretemps that are coming up on terms of the spying. I don't think the French don't spy.
It's or the Brits.
Well,
I mean, or anyone else. But is that the fundamental problem here? Is that tacitly everyone kind of acknowledges that this is happening. But when these things emerge in this fashion, it seems to upset some people more than others.
It's funny in a way the Americans. Are hoisting their own petard. The claims of exceptional morality as well as exceptional military power means that other countries expect them to live up to this. Mm-hmm. Well, this is unlikely to be the case. The Germans, I think, almost don't trust themselves as much as they don't trust the Americans. If they get caught up in this sort of thing, who knows what demons will be loosened in the German psyche and all this sort of stuff. Certainly, there's been an awful lot of worry, as we all know. Germans feeling that if they get too involved in the military, that will open the box. And I think probably this is a bit of that. But Americans are supposed to be their great friends, you know. You don't spy on your friends. Well, I don't really believe that for a moment in international relations.
It's funny, all the people I speak to on this program and others, they all say the same thing, that they don't believe it. And yet you still get this sort of pretty harsh rhetoric from people like the German president. What's the enduring damage? Well, I just wonder, exactly. given what he said, do we just write that off as he's saying
what
he has to say? But does it risk doing enduring damage to the actual relationship between senior figures on these two different
countries? It doesn't risk doing enduring damage, but it definitely does damage. You know, why is it that Gauck and others have to come out with a strong response, even though they know it takes place? They have to for politics. They have to for their publics. And unless people are actually going to step up and say to their publics, you know what? You know, either we're just going to keep this kind of thing quiet, option number one, or we're not going to keep it quiet, but we're going to say, yeah, you know what? And we'd do it too if we had the opportunity to do it. In which case they get voted out, you know, they're not going to do that. And so we understand why, you know, leaders get up and object. We understand why they do, particularly with the United States, because, you know, America does tend to hold itself up as this kind of moral authority, or others hold America up as a moral authority, oddly enough. And so it has further to fall. And the fact remains that America has more money and more resources to put at this, and therefore they're not necessarily better at it, but they do it more. They're more effective at this, and people don't like that either. So Of course, it causes all sorts of challenges. Is it going to do irreparable damage? No, absolutely not, because the relationship with all of the countries we've been mentioning is far stronger than this. Will it do temporary damage? Absolutely it will. And it certainly changes the way the public sees the United States. And that then filters in time into what the governments can actually do together because of public constraints.
Let's move on and talk about another issue, which is very much sort of focuses on the view of the US from without, and that's gun control or the lack of it in the country. We see regular instances of appalling specific examples, school shootings, this sort of thing. But some astonishing figures from the 4th of July weekend in the city of Chicago. 82 people were reportedly shot over the weekend, with as many, I think, as a dozen fatalities. It's a divisive issue, but those numbers are absolutely staggering for one metropolitan area. We've got some new campaigns, a grassroots campaign backed by the former mayor of New York, Mike Bloomberg, with $50 million and some pretty powerful rhetoric as well, opening field offices to try and challenge some of the traditional views in the country. Do you think that the position, from the the NRA, people on the right, Republican movement on gun control is tenable, given the continuing instances of these sorts of numbers and those sorts of attacks that I mentioned earlier?
The one thing you forget, or not forget, but haven't had the opportunity to mention, is the Constitution, the worship Americans have of the Constitution. The Second Amendment says Congress will not abridge the right to bear arms. So in order to change that, you need two-thirds majority in both houses of Congress and two-thirds majority in the legislatures of three-quarters of the states. This is not going to happen in a hurry. So that not only is there can be a certain righteousness about backing this, because that's what the Founding Fathers wanted and so forth and so on. Can we get it incrementally? I don't see why not. I think taking on the NRA, it's not just Bloomberg. There's another philanthropist politician, of course, who's put in $3 million towards this. I can imagine the attack ads already, little children being mown down with an assault rifle in the middle of a supermarket or something, could do the same sort of thing in the other direction that the NRA does with theirs. But I think there's too huge a part of the country that believes in the right to bear arms for this to happen very fast. You'll notice that Bloomberg is going, 14 states, mm-hmm. not taking on the country, bit by bit.
But what about the specifics of an example like this in Chicago, Xenia? How is it possible that you can have a weekend like that? Because people will say, well, look, I was in downtown Chicago. I didn't see any of this. This speaks to a lawlessness. You've had Rahm Emanuel and others on the police force saying this isn't a situation we can control. I mean, that's extraordinary language. Where does it end?
I'll take you, yes, the Chicago example is awful. But the worst one is, of course, 2 years ago, December, when, a number of school children at school were killed. And yet, Obama and the administration put huge effort into trying to change some of the laws, bills passed that restricted what ended up being very, very loose things. I mean, things just as simple as saying, you needed a check that somebody was rational and didn't have a record before you sold them a weapon, and wasn't able to do that. Things that any European would just think are, no-brainers, frankly, and couldn't get it passed. And so, I agree with what Kathleen says. There is this inherent belief that the Constitution is inviolable, and that is countering what is otherwise a logical, this is a no-brainer. I mean, we can't allow this to happen. What is interesting about these new initiatives by Bloomberg and others is they're essentially taking the NRA at their own game. And I'm not aware whether that's been done with any significant amount of money. I mean, of course it's been done, but it hasn't been done with any significant amount of money. It will be interesting to see whether, Bloomberg's a smart guy, whether he can actually start to change the way, using the same techniques, change the way people vote.
Just as a final thought then, Kathy, I'm interested in this idea of how people perceive the Constitution and these constitutional rights. Then is it wrong to look at it as a right and left, as a Democratic and Republican? Are there plenty of liberal thinking Americans who are as uneasy as people on the right of the spectrum about making amendments or even discussing making amendments to those constitutional rights? Is it not really party political? It's about something more fundamental than that.
Well, the US is organized around an idea, and this idea is codified in the Constitution. If it's unconstitutional, it's un-American. And there we go. So both sides, yes, have a fidelity to the Constitution for fear, you know, hold on to nurse for fear of finding something worse. So I don't think issues can be party political, but a reverence for the Constitution is not party political.
I sense that this will not be the last time that we discuss this one either, but there we must leave it for today. That was Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at UCL, and Xenia Dormandy, US Project Director at Chatham House. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House.
Pleasure.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是Monaco 24.
Outlondo, tu vai Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europa.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
There's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll hear what's making the news in Melbourne and row the boat of university champions. That is going to make good listening. But before all of that, though, let's get the latest world news headlines. We'll hear from James Luckhurst.
Israeli forces have been bombing the Gaza Strip in strikes that Palestinian officials say have killed at least 11 people. The action steps up what threatens to become a long-term offensive against the Islamist group Hamas after scores of rockets hit Israeli towns. The Afghan presidential contender Abdullah Abdullah has claimed victory in last month's poll, despite results giving a lead to his rival Ashraf Ghani. Addressing supporters in the capital, Kabul, Mr. Abdullah repeated claims that the election was marred by fraud. The US Attorney General Eric Holder has urged countries in Europe and elsewhere to do more to keep their own citizens from travelling to Syria to fight. He warned that the world cannot allow Syria to become a training ground for violent extremists. And the Islamist militant group Boko Haram has been blamed for at least 18 attacks on civilians in northern Nigeria in the past 2 weeks. A senior UN official has warned that escalating violence of the insurgency threatens the security of West Africa. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. More news at the top of the hour, of course, but right now it's time to check in with one of our far-flung correspondents. Today we head to Melbourne, and our man there is Adrian Craddock. Hello, Adrian. How are you?
Hi, Tom. I'm well.
Good, good. Now, we're going to start with, this is an issue that keeps cropping up time and again. Pretty divisive where you are and garners a lot of attention, positive and negative, around the world. This issue of asylum seekers, these people who are arriving by ocean in Australia, very divisive. There's a big injunction. Tell us why this injunction has happened.
Sure. I mean, as you were saying, I mean, it's been rumbling along in this country for decades. And particularly within this government, it seems to have really come to a head. It's made Australians stand up and ask themselves where they stand on this issue. And over the weekend, quite a peculiar thing happened. 150 asylum seekers from Sri Lanka were intercepted off the Australian coast, and they were subjected to what the Australian government called enhanced screening. And what this basically means is, they were each given 5 minutes on a video conference where they were asked a few questions, and within that 5 minutes, it seems, it was determined whether they assume refugee status. But before that could be completed, a group of human rights lawyers in Australia have lodged an injunction with the High Court, the highest court in Australia, to basically ask the question, is Australia living up to its international obligations, and is this lawful?
And I wonder, Adrian, what's been the reaction, you know, within the country and where you are? Because, as you mentioned there, a lot of these lawyers and activists have been very vocal, very outspoken about this. Does that represent the collective view? What do sort of polls tell us about what your sort of man in the street thinks about how this is being handled?
It's quite hard to really determine how the entire country feels about it, because, I mean, the opposition has accused the government of trashing Australia's reputation. I mean, as you said in your introduction, I mean, this news has really travelled around the world and has, you know, done damage to the way people see this country. But at the same time, a poll came out recently by the company Essential. And while it confirmed that Tony Abbott is still a deeply unpopular prime minister, it's indicated that the average Australian is still on board with the way he's tackling this issue, that they're still behind him, which is fairly curious.
And I gather, Adrian, that some of the people involved in this, both the sort of ministers and other officials, have kind of tied themselves up in knots in some regards, certainly when it comes to trying to communicate what they think and what they're doing to the public. Tell us about some documents you've seen.
Exactly. I mean, that's what makes this injunction so significant. It could bring an end to a really long period of secrecy. I mean, in particular, the face of this whole movement is Immigration Minister Scott Morrison. He's become the butt of many jokes in this country, purely because, I mean, he's been giving some press conferences that can only be described as, you know, Monty Python-esque. I mean, I've got one in front of me, a transcript, where he gave an impromptu press conference in Canberra where he was saying that he would only report on significant events at sea. And if you humour me, I've actually, this is the transcript. So one of the journalists actually said, "So could you clarify what a significant event involving a boat on water would be?" And the minister said, "I mean, when you see me standing here and reporting it, that's when it's significant." And the journalist said, "You are standing here reporting," to which the minister responded, "I'm not. I'm standing here to report that there's nothing to report, basically. there's no significant event for me to report today." And he's saying this at a press conference in front of you know, a gallery full of journalists. So, as you say, I mean, completely tying himself up in knots. And I think that is the source of a lot of the frustration that surrounds this debate.
Adrian, let's move on and look to Japan. We've got Japanese Prime Minister Abe visiting Australia. He's signing some new free trade agreements. That's pretty exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, he's definitely got the full welcome from the Australian government. I mean, he's received a 19-gun salute, and he's addressed the Australian Parliament in English. He's only one of three Japanese leaders to do that. And in the speech, I mean, he delivered some pretty frank observations about how the relationship between the two countries has changed since the Second World War. And he was saying how, you know, the horrors of the past can never be committed again. But in the whole, it was a fairly positive kind of event. I mean, he's the first Japanese leader to visit Australia since 2002. So it was all about strengthening the relationship between Japan and Australia. And I think this free trade agreement will do some fairly interesting things for both countries.
Adrian, before you leave us, let me just ask you about the Senate sitting for the first time yesterday. Well, the first proper session actually today. Tell us about some of the faces then in this Senate. Who are we going to see, and what do we expect to learn more about them?
Yeah, well, there are some really colourful characters that are part of the Senate in this upcoming term. One that I think you'll particularly like. I think I remember when I was in London, you know, you love a good Australian cliche, a good Australian character, and Ricky Muir is definitely that. He's the head of the Motoring Enthusiast Party, and there's a lot of controversy about how he joined the Senate. I mean, he got through on preferences. He only got something like 0.5% of votes. But he is the ultimate, you know, Aussie bloke. You know, before he was elected, there was a lot of controversy. There was a YouTube video that circulated where he was throwing kangaroo poo at his children. And there was a lot of controversy about there was a lot of questions about whether that was, you know, appropriate for a senator to do. And then more recently, yeah, it's not, again, it's not great for Australia's reputation abroad, depending on how you look at it. But, I mean, more recently, he gave an interview to one of Australia's highest profile journalists, and he couldn't even explain what balance of power means. And it's quite scary considering, you know, he is one of the people who potentially holds the balance of power, since there are, you know, a record number of crossbenchers in the current Senate. So it'll be interesting to see how he adapts in the Senate, and particularly how he tackles one of the big issues in Australia, which is repealing the carbon tax.
Yeah, I rather doubt that he's going to look at that with a particularly sort of green sensibility, one wonders. But it'll be very interesting to watch his progress, kangaroo dung and all. Adrian Craddock, thanks as always for joining us here on the programme. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Stay tuned.
Climb aboard the Africa Express with Monocle's Robert Bound as he straps in the jump seat for a jaunt around the Horn.
Berbera is where more passengers got on than there were seats for them to sit on. A subtle tussle ensued in which class, nationality, religion and the supposed seniority of each was played out. Why were the other passengers flying this route? Most shook their heads, some said business, as in it's none of yours.
Hop, skip and jump on the Africa Express, a photographic essay now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, 1841 here in London. Now, we like to keep on top of all the latest styles here at Monocle, and we cover the big news out of Milan Fashion Week and from Pitti in Florence. But alongside the fashion news, there's always time to talk about timeless classics. One such staple, of course, is the blazer. It manages to be contemporary and traditional at the same time. This icon of sartorial style has inspired legions of fans, many, of course, on the other side of the Atlantic from its origins here in Britain, too. A new book, Rowing Blazers, by Jack Carlson, explores the world of the blazer and the sometimes arcane world of rowing clubs. It was rowing that first piqued Jack's interest and inspired him to travel the world to document this colourful and, to many outsiders, sometimes pretty complex world. And he's with me in the studio. Jack, welcome to Midori House. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I guess the first thing that will strike people if they're lucky enough to leaf through this hefty volume, is the astonishing sort of, the colours. I mean, is it something as simple as that that really grabs you to think about, before we even talk about the sort of rowing tradition? The actual blazers themselves are things of pretty rare beauty, aren't they?
They are. And it was seeing just the array of colours and the bizarre stripes and colour combinations of some of these blazers that really inspired me to undertake this project. When you go to Henley, and Henley just ended this year on Sunday, when you go to Henley, you just see the full array, the full spectrum, all the colors of the rainbow. And in 2004, my first trip to Henley, I was just so amazed by all these bizarre colors. And that's really what inspired me to learn the histories and stories and anecdotes behind the blazers.
And we should point out, to if our listeners aren't familiar, Henley's this great sort of regatta, very very traditional occasion here in the UK. And it is interesting, isn't it? There's so much of this sort of fairly esoteric sort of English history involved in a lot of these things. You've got the boat race, of course, but all of these strange quirks and traditions. I wonder how fun was that as you sort of completed this extraordinary journey to unpick some of these traditions and almost bizarre some of the sort of little historical details, aren't they?
Yeah, no, it was really good fun. And some of this is really not documented. It's just passed down orally and, just in the clubs themselves. So the only way to find out some of these stories was to actually go to the clubs. And you're right, it's very, very English, although it's actually the Dutch clubs that have some of the most bizarre blazer-related traditions. I mean, it's common in the Dutch student rowing clubs that the blazers will be passed down from generation to generation. So no one actually owns their own blazer. When you retire, you give your blazer to one of the new rowers coming up through the club. And that means that all the blazers are, you know, pretty ill-fitting. and they also have this tradition that the blazers don't get washed unless its current wearer wins the varsity, which is very difficult, very rare. So you sometimes have blazers that are 80, 90, 100 years old that have never been cleaned.
Now, and, I was going to say, I mean, is that, I can understand the sort of romantic historical appeal of that. It's got to be a bit ripe, though, hasn't it, on occasions?
Oh, it has. And the Dutch rowers, you know, swanning around the stewards' enclosure at Henley Royal Regatta get some very funny looks. Just generations of beer and sweat and river water soaked into these things. They also traditionally fight using their blazers. They grab each other by the lapels and try to wrestle each other to the ground after all the traditional Dutch regattas. So they're not only old, they're not only unwashed, but they're also torn and shredded.
In two pieces. Well, there's a couple of people who, with only half a jacket in some of these. Now, of course, you're in this this handsome volume as well, Jack. There you are in your. I must say, it's sort of relatively conservative, that one. It's pretty kind of sensible, would you say?
Well, American schools and universities and rowing clubs generally don't get blazers made unless they're making the trip over to compete over here in the UK. And I got that blazer in 2004. It's just, you know, navy blue with contrast white binding. And we thought those were so flash and so wild when we got
little
them made up
know.
In 2004. And that was kind of the funny thing, was then arriving over here, going down to the regatta site and seeing, you know, people with orange and pink striped blazers and, you know, things that were far, far wilder, made ours look like the most conservative ones there.
Now, I was going to ask you whether you have a favourite. I mean, this is one of mine. This is the, I mean, perhaps you could tell us about this one. This is the Doggett's coat and badge. Almost, I mean, very, very kind of old school. Looks like something that you might be wearing around the Vatican City almost. Did you have a favourite? Is it one of these really quirky ones, or was it one of the kind of traditionally appealing ones?
I think one of my favourite ones, just because it is quite quirky, it is just one of those funny traditions, is probably Hampton School. Its normal blazer is yellow and black stripes, very, you know, very bold, stands out at Henley. But there's a special blazer called the Hampton Curtains blazer that you only get by winning all three of the major student rowing events in a single year. And it's called the Curtains blazer because it's literally made from the curtains hanging in the school's great hall. They cut down the curtains, and it's this horrible Hessian cloth, you know, never made to have blazers tailored from it, emblazoned with rampant lions and Saxon crowns. And we shot Johnny Searle, who's a 1992 Olympic gold medalist, wearing his curtains blazer. There are only 10 of them in the world, so I thought
Here he is in the book looking like he's enjoying himself for that shoot, I think.
He is. The shoot was funny itself. I mean, most of these shoots, you know, took an hour or two, and we had to get Johnny Searle in the book because it is such a rare blazer. And we got to his house to do the photo shoot, and he said, "How long is this going to take?" And we said, "Well, how long do you have?" And he said, "Well, I've got to go pick up the kids from swimming in 7 minutes." We said, "Right, sit down, do the shoot right now." But it's come out really well. It's one of my favourite photos in the book as well.
It's brilliant. There's even a dog in it for aficionado. And it intrigues me how the sort of the culture of rowing clubs and these different traditions do travel around the world. I mean, it's a very sort of very well researched and very wide ranging book. Did it strike you as you did travel around how different people, different countries, did have some different attitudes as you went around, or were there some kind of identifiable things that were very much the same wherever you went?
I mean, you know, it's very English at its heart. I think the Dutch had the funniest traditions. The Americans have a very different take on the rowing blazer than the British do. And I thought that was sort of interesting to see. I mean, on the cover, we've got Jeff Roth from Cambridge, who did the boat race in 2010. And you can just see how filthy his blazer is at the bottom. And, you know, there's no strict rule like there is in Holland about these things. But, you know, the blazers are kind of battle gear for riotous boat club dinners and the like. And you can always tell the Americans at Henley because their blazers are absolutely immaculately clean, you know, always worn with crisp white trousers, and it almost looks like a uniform or something. And so there's just a slightly different attitude toward the blazer. But I think both cultures have this great respect for the garment.
They do indeed. And if you want to know more, and you should, you can find the book Rowing Blazers by Jack Carlson. It's published by Thames and Hudson. It's out now and you should pick up a copy. Jack, thanks very much for coming to see us and tell us all about it.
My pleasure.
It's almost time for our weekly music review next on Midori House. To get us there, let's listen to a song we shall hear more about in just a couple of minutes' time. This is Oscar and the Wolf and it's Strange Entity. That was Oscar and the Wolf, Strange Entity. Fittingly enough, it plays us into our musical review slot. I'm delighted to be joined by Nick Luscombe. Nick, welcome back to the programme. Paul Noble, Monocle's musical maestro, is alongside us as well. Tell us a bit more about Oscar and the Wolf, a Belgian band. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, they're from Belgium.
That's news in itself.
That's it, yeah. I don't think I've got that many new Belgian records apart from Melanie the what's her name, Paul? You'll know
Melanie the Don't put me on the spot like that.
That's good. I like so, it. Let's grill Paul Noble. That's nice stuff. I like
it. Great track. Yeah. I don't know what the album's like. I haven't heard that yet, but it's produced by Leo Abrahams, who's worked with a lot of interesting people.
He works with John Hopkins, who's been into Monocle a few times.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very nice moody sound.
Yeah.
With a bit of pop thrown in.
Absolutely. So I kind of just thought it was a good track and. It's quite poppy, right? But it's got
I like it. It had a kind of sort of dreamy quality. And we were just talking about blazers before. I was in a kind of multicolored, multi-striped blazer.
Well, I have to say, I was at Henley last week.
In your blazer, Paul?
In a blazer. Oh, yes. Sweating it out in the blazing sun with my Pims on the
go. What was your blazer color scheme?
I just went with the classic navy.
That's it. That seems to be.
You have to be part of a boating club to go for one of these outrageous striped things. But yeah, there were some fantastic looks going on there. Didn't realize there was a whole book.
You're a classic navy man as well.
No, I'm from Plymouth as well, so I should be.
Oh, you should have all of the kind of maritime heritage.
No,
right?
Exactly.
Let's move on. We're going to talk. What are we going to hear from next? We've got Taylor McFerrin.
Taylor McFerrin. Yeah, this is from his new album Brain Feeder, which is quite an extraordinary record, I think. Beautifully produced and but with great songs. It's got everything for me. It's definitely one of the highlights, I think, of the year, actually, for me.
I'd go along with that. You would know Taylor McFerrin's dad, obviously, Tom. Have a guess.
Bobby?
It was Bobby.
Oh, nice.
Yes, Bobby.
See, don't try and stick me with these quiz questions.
I thought you'd get it.
Should we do? Should we take a listen and then have a bit of a...
Yeah, let's listen.
Let's have a listen. So this is The Antidote.
Gently bows from the beat of a hunger that can't be drowned. I could breathe this bliss on the water, and it must be the sound. Velvet, a hue and tissue, a compass that some men sweet surrender deep in my chest.
So that's Taylor McFerrin, and this album is, there's a very cool scene going on in LA built around a few things. There's the label Brain Feeder, and there's a club called The Low End Theory, and there's a producer called Flying Lotus, or Fly Low to his friends, who is the sort of the champion of the scene. And it's very sort of future thinking beat music, but a lot of it's really indulgent and just bizarre and, you know, interesting production, and actually... you couldn't whistle it. Whereas this album, and I think that's what you said, is just great songs.
Great songs, right? And I mean, obviously some great players. Robert Glasper was involved, Thundercats, all those guys were on it. But it's really accessible, actually, which you'd hope from Bobby McFerrin's son in a way, right?
And he's on it, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he plays on one track,
You'd have to get your dad in to do some.
That's right. Wearing that blazer that we're looking at right now.
With a nice shaggy dog next to him.
Perfect stuff. We got some more music as well. Green Lines. Tell us a bit about this one, Nick.
Yeah, Green Lines are from Tokyo and Cambridge. So it's an international duo based in two different countries. This is the second album. They're really inspired by 80s music, basically. And this one, it kind of takes it to another level with sort of Paul Hardcastle, I'd say, has been a very big influence on it. Yeah, I'd love to know what you think about this, actually.
Let's take a listen and then we'll find out. So this track is Chauffeur Driven.
I think that's an exclusive, you know, because they sent that to me just about a couple of days ago, and I don't think anyone's actually ever played it. So I think that's, the first time, certainly in the UK, and I think even in Japan. So, yes.
I definitely recognise that flute sound from, it was a keyboard I got given for my bar mitzvah in 1985. So they've obviously picked one up.
I like it. Well, that kind of 80s synth action there. Yeah, that was fantastic. Nice thing. I'd take off my heavily striped blazer and have a gentle get down to that.
How do you think the collaboration between Cambridge and Tokyo works?
Yeah, I guess it's the power of the internet. Yeah. I don't know how they've got their system set up, but yeah, it works, and they seem to be pretty productive as well.
Because as we know at Monocle 24, it's always the wrong time to talk to Japan. Either they're going to bed or we're going to bed.
That's a good point, yeah.
But maybe a meeting of creative minds, you know, morning person, evening person.
They'll be
person.
Up late, they're musicians.
Exactly. Yeah, that's it.
They'll be jamming.
You meet in the middle, and it's a great outcome. That was Chauffeur Driven, Green Lines. I really like that. I thought that was really good. That was Nick Luscombe and Paul Noble. Thank you both very much indeed for coming in to talk to us through some of those new tracks. A little bit of an exclusive as well for you on Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's show, though. My thanks to Nick and Paul, to my special guests earlier, Zania Dormandy and Kathleen Burke, who talked us through the big stories of the day. The show was produced by Isabel Kaiser, researched by Gaia Lutz and Johan Laux, and our studio manager was Bill Lutie. Tom Morris is next with Section D. Monocle Daily's coming your way at 2200. This show will be back at 1800 hours London time tomorrow. But for this edition from me, Tom Edwards, that is all. Goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.